So this is Sam McCleary from EG here with Andrew Baum, who has just delivered to the market a quite hefty piece of research on prop tech. Andrew, do you want, before we get into that, do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came about writing a very detailed report on prop tech?
Sure. Yes. I've been mixing life as a teacher in universities for a long time, teaching property valuation and property investment, property finance and all that sort of thing. And at the same time, I've been a consultant or a fund manager or a property researcher in business. So I've worked for people like the Pru and Henderson, CBRE and so on. And my business expertise has usually been international property investments, that sort of thing. And while I've been happily pursuing these twin track careers, it's been very difficult not to get involved in innovation. And the innovation that I first got involved in was in the late 90s when the dot-com boom was taking off, and I got involved in a technology company that was producing a Bible for the property industry. And ever since then, I've had some fingers in some tech businesses. I've been trying to teach MBA students and executives about strategy and thinking about what the world's going to be like in 5 or 10 years' time. And all in all, the latest splurge of prop tech businesses is an irresistible topic for me in trying to understand how the world's going to be in the future, both for my own investments, for my advisory business, and for the people in my classroom.
And do you think that then this document that you've pulled together is really that sort of education, not just for your students, but I guess, you know, one of the things that we notice as a sort of content provider is that there's quite a lot of questions out there from the traditional property industry about, you know, really understanding what tech is, and particularly what prop tech is, and what it means for them.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to produce something that was objective and as balanced as possible. I mean, we all think that our views are objective, and of course, they never are. But I wanted to produce a balanced report which captures some of the excitement, some of the real excitement amongst the millennial generation about these businesses and the opportunities to change what is a conservative, slow-moving industry that tends to be dominated by a very, very precisely defined group of people. I wanted to capture their excitement, but at the same time wanted to push back a little bit and give the benefit of expert opinion on the limitations to prop tech, so the things that it probably won't be able to change, certainly not very quickly. So I was keen to produce something that was reasonably well researched, and you know, it is 95 pages. There's plenty of it, and the material comes from 50 interviews with prop tech VCs, entrepreneurs, and real estate people. So those three different groups of people, all with different vested interests. The interviews took place in San Francisco, Boston, and London. And I've
it
had
must
some...
have been terrible for you having to go to San Francisco and Boston.
Well, yeah, San Francisco is an irresistible sort of place. I think to really understand the way the world is, there's a fantastic difference between the US and the UK in the way that technology is funded. There's so much more money going into it in the US that you can't really get a feel for it by being in London. Mm. There's lots of activity in London, you know, feverish entrepreneurial activity, but it tends to be bootstrapped or very poorly funded. Whereas in the US, you do see businesses that raise $100 million and really do things properly.
And do you think that will come to London? Do you think we're just a little bit behind them, or is that just not how we operate over here?
Well, my experience leads to a certain degree of scepticism, really, that, you know, the way of the world usually is that the Americans put a lot of money into developments that can thrive and survive in what is a very big market of 350 people, and then they come over here and buy our businesses. Mm-hmm. because we've never expansively attacked the single market of our 350 million people, because, you know, despite the fact that we have an EU and you know, pre-Brexit we had a single market, we never really had a single market for property technology energy or property services. You know, it was a very, very split market. The Germans do things a certain way. The Brits do things a different way. So we're just sitting there, really, as we're sitting ducks, ready to be taken over by the big beast, and that's what's going to happen again.
Yeah, and I guess there's almost a sort of inbuilt pride's not the right word, but we quite like being like, oh well, this is the way we do it, and that's the way they do it, isn't it? This kind of we like to put those barriers around ourselves sometimes, I think.
Brexit's the perfect illustration of it, isn't it? And yes, I think we do, and you know, in some ways, we like being. In partnership with our, you know, our special relationship with our big brother. And so, you know, the big businesses, the big survivors from the first wave of prop tech were CoStar, Argus, very, very few others. You know, they mopped up American businesses, and then they've come over here and mopped up our businesses as well. Mm. So I can see that happening again. We will have some, you know, large, successful, independent survivors, that's for sure. But I think we need to get ready for the idea that, you know, the big co-working brand, which is a prop tech, one of my prop tech sectors, WeWork, is worth 17 billion, or supposedly worth 17 billion. It's worth more than British Land and Hammerson and Land Securities. I mean, it's only been going since 2010. That illustrates the sheer scale. And, you know, one day WeWork will buy somebody like British Land just to use their office space.
Yeah. It's a crazy thought, isn't it? But not crazy in terms of how quickly it could happen, but not crazy in the fact that it couldn't ever happen.
Well, what's crazy is that the biggest five businesses in the world are all in exactly the same business. They're all in tech. So Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and what's the other one? Microsoft. They're all building huge data centers because their core business is the collecting of massive pieces of data, which has to be stored somewhere, and it's being stored in these whacking great 1 million square feet data storage plants, which are being built all over the place. And one of the changes that we're going to see down the road is that instead of buying offices, we'll be buying data centers, because they're a real growth market.
And we're already starting to see that, aren't there? There's a lot of chat about the data center market as an investment. But I guess it's quite a complex one, as there's all sorts of security issues and the like that go with them, so you need to be quite an intelligent investor, I suppose, for that sort of asset.
Yes, unfortunately, we need intelligent investors. That's interesting concept. We do have some, but we do tend to be so conservative. You know, we do tend to hold back and continue to think that the way to invest is office, retail, industrial. And, you know, in 10 years' time, maybe residential will be thinking that's a natural part of our investment portfolio. But there's so much other stuff out there to invest in. Mm. And technology is really changing that. You know, technology is changing the investability of offices because leases are shortening, flexible use, co-working, all those things are changing the nature of office investment. Retail's already been completely disrupted by technology. Logistics is being pushed along by technology, and it's you know, the pattern of logistics in industrial space is changing completely. So you've got to be extremely flexible now in the investments that you think about buying.
Now, in the earlier you talked about the sort of what's exciting the millennials, and then sort of trying to give the counter of that and the technologies that might not be as exciting as they appear. Can you talk us through some of those that you highlight in the report?
Yeah, of course, Samantha. The report tries to corral all of the businesses that I came across. Now, I came across about 150 businesses that are referred to in the report. I tried to narrow down the number of categories that they operate within to three. There's a construction technology industry, which I'll leave to one side for now. But out of that, or apart from that, there are three main sectors. There's a smart building sector, which is characterized best by businesses like Google Nest and the Internet of Things. Mm. It's to do with the operation and management of buildings and the exchange of data between buildings and human beings, so that at its lowest level, you can turn your heating on as you're going home with your mobile phone. But at the highest level, you have a set of interconnected buildings providing data back to a central facility, which can then monitor and manage the energy use in a building in an efficient way, or in a city in an efficient way. So the use of big data to make smart cities is an extension of that smart real estate sector. It was very interesting. I was at the Facebook headquarters talking to their head of real estate, and I learned a huge amount about that sector from him. And you know, the issues that are coming out of that are to do with energy use. If you have a 1 million square foot data center producing huge amounts of heat, where does it get its energy from, and how can you collect the heat back and power the plant properly? And so the concept of building sitting on power generation plants is getting closer and closer, I think, for big buildings.
Okay.
Then the second, and that's sort of a good thing. It's very difficult to see that sector as anything other than just a positive, continuing, beneficial engineering solution to a problem. Then the second area that is characterized by Airbnb, WeWork, and a few very, very flaky businesses is, I call the shared economy sector. So the shared economy is about the shared use of space. It's not about the operational management of it. It's really about the use of space. And the basic proposition is there's lots of space in the world which isn't used. And all we need to do is make an efficient connection between the potential users of that space with the space. So Airbnb is a great example. You've got spare bedroom. Why not let it out on a nightly hire for bed and breakfast or whatever? And it's extended beyond that to office facilities, to restaurants letting out their space in the afternoons to people with laptops, to sharing your garage space, your car parking spaces. And that's where, to me, it starts to run out of logic and power. You know, I think it becomes something of a millennial fad, a bit of a hippie movement that we should all be communal owners of real estate or users of real estate. You end up talking about co-living as a movement, and mm-hmm. co-living has been successful. There are businesses out there offering co-living through, like, The Collective, for example. But I just wonder whether it's a millennial change of choice that they really want to live in co-living spaces, or whether it's just because when you're in your 20s, you can't afford anything else, and you as soon as you get reasonable money and kids, you move out of that into a traditional house. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll see. So I'm slightly skeptical about that one, despite the fact that WeWork and co-working, I think, is a real change. You know, I think that's here to stay. And then the final one, which is the biggest sector, there are about 100 out of the 150 companies were in this sector, was real estate fintech, as I call it. And that's most easily characterized by Zoopla and Rightmove, Purple Bricks, possibly, and then the commercial search engines, Realla, research databases like Dacha, literally hundreds and possibly thousands of ventures that range from somebody working in his bedroom using technology to crawl over websites to pull them into one particular information engine, to people who are really trying to create exchanges for crowdfunding and secondary sales of units in big office buildings. And peer-to-peer lending platforms like LendInvest, you know, just a huge amount of activity in the equity and debt markets trying to, I'm trying not to use the word disrupt, but that is what they're trying to do. They really are trying to disrupt the standard way in which money is raised to buy buildings.
Okay. And is that, given that most of the firms that you discovered are operating in that sector, is that an element of the prop tech market that you think is set to grow, or is that like the shared economy sector one that is a bit you're not quite sure about?
Well, the shared economy one I'm not sure about. The fintech one I am sure about. Fintech, that there will be some very big, very successful businesses in real estate fintech, and there'll be a huge number of failures. The big guys will hoover up the good ideas. The traditional property businesses will also make sure that they move into those areas of tech that suit them. And it's no surprise or no accident that Rightmove, Zoopla, and OnTheMarket.com are all owned by estate agents to some extent.
Hmm.
So the big guys, the CBREs and the Savills of the world, know what's happening, and they'll all have strategies for dealing with this, and it'll include buying shares in tech businesses or competing head-on with them. And you know, in the same way, if you see WeWork with its massive valuation moving into co-working space and changing the way offices are used, you can see British Land already will be building its own co-working brand and moving in absolutely the opposite direction to compete with WeWork.
Yeah.
So I think real estate fintech is the one where everybody believes that there should be more efficiency in the house selling process and in the commercial property investment process. You know, we shouldn't have to go through lots of lawyers, lots of brokers. You know, we shouldn't be that far removed. And the concept of blockchain becomes massively interesting then, because the idea that you can execute smart contracts directly with a counterparty without having to go through loads and loads of intermediaries and public marketing exercises is appealing to many people. So the big unknown really is real estate fintech and blockchain in particular. And, you know, I have to say, it's very difficult to understand. So it's going to take a long, long time before people get their head around that. But it could be the biggest change of all.
It's one that I struggle with on a daily basis. So I put a call out to Twitter, actually, at the launch of your report, asking if someone could explain it to me in 140 characters. I've got some quite good ones back, but tell me if they're good enough. So I had Greg Isaacson. He said it's a secure but public database to which records can be added, but existing records cannot be modified.
Yep.
That's not too bad. And the
right.
other good one was, where's it gone? Blockchain is a public network for tracking events in a way that prevents tampering. No single owner and very hard to rewrite history.
Yeah.
Which kind of, it helps me a little, but it still but it sort of blows my mind a bit.
It doesn't explain how it can be used for buying and selling property, does it really?
No.
Yeah, at its most fanciful, I've heard people talk about blockchain being lumps of data, secure data that can be transferred between people on a secure basis, and even go as far as the smart contract can be executed by giving that data to somebody who needs the data in return for the money that would buy the title. So at some point, the engine goes into my bank account and sucks out £250,000, and goes into my counterparty's blockchain data ledger and sucks out the title, and they're automatically exchanged, and then I've done the transaction, and that's all done online without any lawyers. And you know, I just can't get my head around that one.
And I don't know if the lawyers would ever let us get our head around that one, because they quite like fees, don't they, lawyers?
Well, they do, but being being a professional, I can understand why people will be reluctant not to use lawyers. You know, it's we need investor protection, and yeah, one of the things I read in researching this book was a book called Future Crimes, which is a very, very scary prognosis of how technology is going to be increasingly dangerous, and the more things that you put online without protection, the more weak our security becomes. And So I think there's going to be a natural human pushback and a regulatory pushback as well that protects the position of chartered surveyors and lawyers, because they're going to be needed to protect people.
Yeah. And I guess that it's a sort of strange situation to be in, isn't it? Because for these kind of technologies to really grow and become useful, we need to become less protective of all the data that we as individuals or companies have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if there's so much out there and it's not secure, then you're not going to want to have it out there. So you're sort of put in this push-pull position, I suppose.
It's a perfect tension. One of the companies I spoke to in San Francisco have a vision, and they are extremely well-funded, partly by Eric Schmidt of Google, for example. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of pounds behind this company. Their vision is that they will be able to value every house in the U.S. and put the valuation online, whether you want it put online or not. So whether your house is for sale or not, there'll still be a public valuation of it online and details of the property online, so that people can simply make an offer for your house whether you're selling or not.
Hmm.
And there's no point in haggling, because everyone knows what the valuation is, because it's public. And not only that, but the mortgage lender won't need to send a value around, because they'll know what it's worth as well, and they'll be able to make you an offer rapidly of a loan. And so the whole house sales process can be cut in half, as long as people are prepared not to object about having their information put online.
Mm.
Now, if you really push this all the way, then you'll have augmented and virtual reality tours of the house added to the website, floor plans, all sorts of things that will ideally be able to make the transaction of the house efficient and rapid. But do you really want somebody taking pictures of the inside of your house on a real-time basis in order that it's easily transactable?
Big brother, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Do you think there will come a point when we stop, because it feels like we talk about tech in property so much at the moment, do you think there will come a point when we stop talking about tech and it just becomes real estate?
Yes, definitely. That's a really good point. Very good point, Samantha. I mean, we were talking about infotech. We've forgotten that term now. Infotech came out of the dot-com boom. In the dot-com boom, we were all talking about technology companies. We were incredibly excited. Everything was going online. And then it stopped. It just stopped with a sudden full stop in 2001. And then we just went back to being property investors again. And there were a few sort of buy now, old hat companies just doing things using technology, but then there's nothing special about it. And I think this wave has already passed its peak, actually. I think the fact we're talking about it so much means it really is just passing its peak now. I think we're already seeing that the big money is going to the bigger companies. There are decreasing numbers of new ideas out there now. So I reckon this one's going to run till about 2020 or something, and then it'll slow down and stop, and you have a few big companies doing things that we just take for granted.
Mm. And does that mean then that there's some of the technologies that are being talked about at the moment that sound frightening or exciting that we'll just we'll all forget about in a few years' time and think and let them go back to the movies?
Yes. I think blockchain is the big unknown. If I knew the answer to that one, I would be much more positive about my forecasts of it. But I really, really don't know what will happen with blockchain. That's the one that we all need to sort of try to get our heads around. And the internet, the blockchain is not just a real estate thing. It's like it's the second phase of the internet. And if the second phase of the internet happens, then that's really disruptive and exciting and wonderful. And some people believe it is wonderful. It's going to be the second internet. So that's the unknown in my world. I think a lot of other things will just be pushed back and won't happen, and other things will just become natural. So that, Zoopla, for example, is just the natural way in which you start your house buying process now. Yeah. And you don't buy magazines to buy cars, you go online. And so things like that will become natural. I think the idea that your house value is put online and is public, I think that will become natural. I don't think there's a problem with that. And there'll be more and more AR and VR used to show property, and there'll be more and more online sharing of data, and more apps that simply exchange data between occupiers and their brokers and their agents. And I think more and more of that, but I think it'll just be sequential, and we won't see it as a big prop tech revolution. It'll just be a sequential movement. So we are going through a real burst. There is something special going on right now. I call it prop tech 2.0. It started 2 or 3 years ago. Actually, it came out of the global financial crisis where people were frustrated with the way things were working. Something was clearly wrong. So a lot of young people said, right, we're going to do something about this. And it's very, very exciting. But I think it's sort of coming to just beyond the midpoint now of that wave. And it'll become not old hat, but it'll become normal business in about 2 or 3 years' time. And then we'll move on to the next wave.
PropTech 3.0.
That's the one, and that's blockchain, and that's 2020 to 2025, somewhere around then. And I'd love to. Well, hopefully, I will still be alive to see what's going on then.
How long will that report be?
I might not write it. I might leave that to somebody else.
Well, surely by then we'll have robots to write it for us. And
well, yeah. That's
there'll be some algorithm out there.
Yeah, there's a whole other topic then about what our cities will look like and how many jobs there will be left and whether we'll have driverless cars and, all those things which are also in the report. And, we can all develop our visions of that. But driverless cars over my dead body, please.
So that's the piece of tech that you don't want to come in. What's the, before we say goodbye, what's the one piece of tech that you think... you either love and use now or would love to see introduced?
Well, at a really prosaic level, we should have really brilliant apps that enables us to share cars. You know, if I'm driving somewhere in a car with one person in it in clogged up traffic, I should have three people sitting in it with me because they're doing the same journey. Mm. So there's no reason why that app can't exist. It's just, you know, we're just incredibly inefficient in the way we think about this. So I would love to see technology sort of help transportation. We shouldn't be having to be massively congested. So we need to improve our lateral travel. The other thing I think is going to happen is we're going to end up with very tall buildings, more and more tall buildings, and more vertical travel, so that we'll be, I think there will be some co-living space, there'll be some apartment buildings on the top, there'll be some co-working space in the building so we can work during the day. There'll be a gym, there'll be a school, there'll be a health centre, there'll be all those things stacked vertically because vertical travel is just faster than lateral travel. Mm. And I think there'll just be buildings will just get higher. And it's already started. If you go to Hong Kong, it's already a bit like that.
There's a big discussion around planning to be done with that as well then, I suppose, as particularly here in London anyway, there's not always the greatest love for towers, is there?
No. I mean, they don't have to be huge, but they have to be mixed use. And you know, the concept of mixed use is the thing that we've got to get our heads around. You know, they are genuinely exciting buildings to be in, you know, mixed-use buildings with co-working space and people living there and shopping there, and you know, it's the function played by a hotel in the emerging market. You know, I remember being in Warsaw in 1990. Everybody was in the Marriott Hotel in Warsaw. They were living there, they were shopping there, they were working there, they were exercising there, and that mixed-use building is what people want to be in.
I guess it's all about whether there's tech involved or not. People like to be around people and communicate and sort of have that community, don't they? So if
what do you think?
I think, well, I'm a country girl, so I quite like being away from people, but you know, I get the vibe that there is when there's a properly mixed use building that does bring lots of people together in a way that makes them feel comfortable and enables them to do what they need to do and want to do. Then I can see the vibrancy in that.
Yeah, I think, you know, WeWork is a brilliant concept. If you go into WeWork, you know, it's got glass partitions because people want to see other people in the building, and people even dress more nicely in a WeWork building because they know they're going to be seen and going to be part of the show. And it's a fascinating illustration of the human condition, I think.
Yeah, I guess none of us can get away from the fact we've got egos, can we?
No, exactly. And you'll be okay because there'll be lots of space in the countryside to go and have a second home.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
Andrew, thank you so much for your time. If people want to sort of connect with you and talk more about the report, how would they do that?
If they simply Google Borm Oxford University, they'll get me and the report. There's a video. You can download the report. It's all there. It's all searchable on the Oxford University website.
Fantastic. Thank you ever so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye, Samantha.
Thanks.